Laudato Jesus Christus, Vatican and World News.
In the headlines this Saturday, the 6th of July, negotiators provide a glimmer of hope for a ceasefire deal for Gaza, while continuing Israeli strikes on the enclave kill 29 Palestinians, including 5 journalists. Iran's new president-elect, a man considered moderate, pledges to serve all. And EU bishops release a document on the challenges posed to families by the ongoing digital revolution. In the Vatican, I'm Linda Bordoni. As the death toll in Gaza climbs to more than 38,000 Palestinians killed since the 7th of October, new Israeli strikes on Saturday claimed the lives of 29 more people, including 5 journalists. Meanwhile, mediators in the latest round of talks between Israeli officials and Hamas representatives say a revised proposal on a Hamas-Israel deal for a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of Israeli hostages, including soldiers, does look possible. The talks taking place in Qatar aim to restart stalled negotiations. An official said if there is a Gaza agreement, then from 0 hour there will also be a ceasefire in Lebanon, where clashes have intensified following exchange of fire between the Israeli army and Hezbollah militants. The main obstacle in the negotiations until this week had been widely differing views on how the agreement would move from its first phase to its second. The first phase involves the release by Hamas of elderly, sick and female hostages during a 6-week truce, an Israeli withdrawal from cities in Gaza, and the release of Palestinian detainees held by Israel. The second phase would involve the release of all remaining hostages, as well as the bodies of those who have died, a permanent end to hostilities, and a full Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. Phase 3 would mark the start of Gaza's reconstruction. In Iran, Masoud Pezeshkian, a man considered a moderate, has won the country's presidential election. Nathan Morley reports.
Pezeshkian, who is a former health minister, won the country's presidential election, surprising many commentators and prompting his supporters to celebrate through the night on the streets of Tehran. The result comes after a second round runoff between Pezeshkian and Saeed Jalili, a former chief negotiator on the nuclear issue. Pezeshkian garnered 16,384,402 of the total 30.5 million votes. The turnout stood at 49.8%. At 69 years old, Pezeshkian is certainly no newcomer to politics. A heart surgeon by profession, he currently sits in the National Parliament, where he once served as the Deputy Speaker. His campaign promised to curb the infamous morality police and strike a fresh nuclear deal with Western powers, with the hope of removing crippling sanctions. Dr. Salam Vakil, the director of Chatham House's Middle East and North Africa program, has been speaking about the new president.
He is second in command in the system, but certainly he will have impact on the economy and economic policy. And he did promise to try and push through some social moderation to give people breathing space after the hijab protests and the reinforcement of Islamic values on the streets. It's interesting that Iranian people continue to vote for reform and change, even if they know that it might not really be the reform and change they're looking for.
This presidential election, which had originally been set for next year, was brought forward following the death of President Ibrahim Raisi and his staff in a helicopter crash back on May the 19th. For Vatican Radio, this is Nathan Morley reporting.
The leaders of 3 West African military governments are meeting together for the first time to cement an alliance created in the face of opposition from neighbouring countries. Soldiers took power in Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger in a series of coups from 2020 to 2023. All 3 countries, which now form the Alliance of Sahel States, have been affected by jihadist violence, in part a reason given for the army takeovers. In January, they all announced a plan to leave the wider regional bloc ECOWAS, which is holding its own summit on Sunday. The Commission of the Bishops' Conferences of the EU has released a document on the challenges posed to families in Europe by the ongoing digital revolution. Lisa Zingarini reports.
The 9-page document released by Commissaire on Friday addresses the dual nature of the digital revolution, pointing to both its benefits and risks, and therefore to the need for a concerted effort to balance technological advancements with the preservation of family values and human dignity as called for by Pope Francis. The contribution identifies some key challenges posed by digitalization, such as social isolation, mental health issues, digital addiction, online risks for children, and on a vaster scale, its cultural and societal impacts affecting traditional Christian and family values. It goes on to highlight the principles of Catholic social teaching, including human dignity, care for the common good, and promoting genuine interactions as vital to address these issues, pointing to the central role of the family. In light of these principles and with the aim to develop a more connected, respectful and human-centred digital environment, the Commissaire Youthnet therefore recommends EU policymakers to implement three pivotal actions. The first is to promote media and information literacy, that is, education focused on critical thinking and ethical principles. Secondly, the contribution calls for more effective regulation to protect children from harmful online content, such as pornography. Finally, it suggests promoting human connections through a social campaign, addressing issues like loneliness and self-esteem. By focusing on education, regulation, and positive digital engagement, the document concludes, we can create an environment that supports both technological advancement and the preservation of core family and societal values. I am Lisa Zingarini.
Catholics in Ireland mark the annual National Rally for Life in the city centre of Dublin. Bishop Kevin Doran of Elphin Diocese and chair of the Irish Bishops' Council for Life presided at the Mass preceding the event. Thaddeus Jones spoke to him just before the celebration about the importance of this event in the life of the Church.
This is an annual event in Dublin, and it takes place through the city centre, and it normally is preceded by a Mass here in the Dominican Church in St. Saviour's Priory, and I've had the privilege a few times of celebrating that Mass, and I suppose it's an opportunity for us as Catholics, in advance of what is, I suppose, a political act, to reflect on our motivations, our own personal commitment to life, to, I suppose, in a sense, purify our motivations and to increase and improve our integrity in the manner in which we respond to life questions, both at the beginning and end of life.
How do you approach life issues in reaching a wider public that goes beyond Catholic members per se on these issues, especially in a world which is so increasingly polarized, where dialogue on some of these issues is very difficult because everyone kind of holds to their own camp without trying to find a way to engage and talk about these issues?
Yeah, this is difficult. I mean, we certainly make ourselves available for interaction on mainstream media, and I have done some interviews on mainstream media here in Ireland in the last week or so on this end-of-life question. We have also presented to that parliamentary committee on assisted suicide, not primarily with the expectation that our view would be heard by the members of the Parliament, but more in the hope that this would also give us an opportunity to publish more widely what our beliefs and our concerns are. So it is challenging. One of the difficulties, I suppose, about social media, which we use a lot, is that there's always a risk that you end up talking to those who share your own views, and you know the people who log on to your particular social media may well be in the same silo as yourself. So we need to certainly break out from that.
And that was Bishop Kevin Doran of Elphin Diocese in Ireland, chair of the Irish Bishops' Council for Life. And finally, the Vatican cricket team is back in the Vatican after an intense week-long Light of Faith tour. that took it to London. Part of the Atletica Vaticana, an umbrella organisation that brings together all the Vatican's athletes, the cricket team had already travelled to 9 destinations since its formation in 2014. The aim of the trip, as always, was to promote dialogue and friendship between the Catholic Church and the host country. Of course, the athletes play a good game, but the true goal is to spread the message of friendship, unity and gospel hope. The emphasis is also on the fact that the players, who are all seminarians and priests based in Rome, are ambassadors for the Catholic priesthood. Joseph Tulloch followed the team's endeavours in London and spoke first to team captain José Etolil and then to coach Dane Kirby, both of whom expressed joy for the successful tour.
I was also very happy when people recognised us as the Vatican cricket team. When we were about to begin the Mass at the Westminster Chapel, in the sacristy, there were some choir boys. When asked by our manager, "Do you know who these priests are?" they shouted, "Yes, we know, they are the Vatican cricket team." And when we are roaming through the city of London in the streets, some people identified us as the Vatican cricket team. "Are you the Vatican cricket team? We have read about you in the newspaper." It's not because we are famous cricketers, but it's because the Vatican cricket team is famous for them. We were not recognized individually, but collectively as the St. Peter's cricket team. So to have that knowledge in England about something that's situated in Rome, in Vatican, it gives how much this team or the Pope's team is famous in England, in the new generation. I'm very happy that people think about the Vatican and the Pope through these efforts that we put in through sports and other engagements.
You're the coach, this is not quite your domain, but you're aware, of course, that this it's very much about what happens on the pitch, but it's also about what happens off the pitch and the building relationships, the building bridges. I don't know if, from your vantage point of obviously the coach of the more technical sporting side, you still have some reflections on that other side of trying to build bridges.
And cricket's a great game for that. There's so much time in the game and so many opportunities in the play where friendship can be expressed rather than combat, so to speak. After all, it is sport. It's not war. And with their vocation, they set the example for that, and we obviously want to try to play in that spirit, and there is the spirit of cricket.
They're a great group of guys, aren't they? They're so humble, so smiley, and they must be very proud also of that aspect of the team.
Yeah, they're themselves. They stay themselves in every situation. They give so much of themselves, and there's a real family atmosphere on tour, and it comes across wherever we play. And so they tend to open people up, and so we also discover lots of things about our opponents or spectators or even just the people who are hosting us wherever we're staying. And there's always a conversation to be had, which is one of the beautiful things about touring with this cricket team compared to other cricket teams that I've worked with.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Vatican and World News. Follow us tomorrow on these same frequencies for Pope Francis's half-day visit to the city of Trieste. My thanks today go to Bruno Orti in studio. In the Vatican, I'm Linda Bordoni. Bye-bye.